Absolute Rally, powered by the Kia Ora Works team. Cordless tools tailored for the world of motorsport.
Hello and welcome to Absolute Rally. It is good to be back for our final episode. I'm glad you enjoyed the double episode. Got really, really positive feedback on that. Really, really appreciate it. We're trying to bring, as ever, the last episode to be a little bit different. We've got a few bits and pieces that are going to be coming up that we weren't planning for this episode, which is always a little bit exciting. So we've got BT Crawford coming up a little bit later on the podcast, talking to Trev, all things about his background of yesteryear rallying, and also obviously being involved with Deja Vu, with Blunt Tindall, and some of the other people who are behind. Of course, Trev was on that the other week, so we've got that coming up. We've also got, you'll have seen on our Twitter feed, that we've shared about quite a lot, VHS videos, which is basically a person who is recreating and kind of saving footage from rallying from yesteryear. And they wanted to rename Anonymous. They don't want people to know who it is. So Alistair, our producer, is going to be the voice. And I'm going to interview Alistair, but he's going to be providing the answers provided by the guys at VHS Video, who've emailed them to us in advance. So it all sounds very cloak and dagger and very mystical, but there's very, very good reasons why. And one of the questions actually deals with the fact why they want to remain anonymous anyway. So that's coming up a little bit later on. There's a couple of other bits and pieces as well. But as ever, at the top of the show, I always say hello to whoever's with me. And this week, it's just Trevor Agnew. And when I say just Trevor Agnew, I mean that in the best possible way, Trevor. I don't mean to, you know, downgrade in any way, shape or form.
Yeah, no pressure at all there. Thanks. How are you doing?
We're all good. We're all good. We had the double episode last week, which enabled me to have a week off after a horrendous Woodpecker rally, which congratulations to everybody on that, and congratulations to MEN, who got their first national win with the R5 car with Ollie. But yeah, it was a nightmare. I needed a week off chasing my toddler son round. So apologies to our listeners for giving you the double episode and not having one last week, but I hope we made up for it anyway. So yeah, Trev, obviously we've not spoke since Deja Vu. We're going to be talking about it a little bit later on. Have you come down from the cloud that you were sharing some stuff on our little kind of group that the four of us have? Some outstanding pictures, some outstanding footage, which also are caught up well on Twitter, of some of these cars. You forget that obviously it wasn't technically a closed road event in any way, shape or form, but one or two people perhaps enjoyed their little drive, shall we say.
Spirited driving was the name of the day. All very legal, all within the speed limits, of course. But when you've got those machines and those drivers who are highly competitive in the day, you're talking about people like Austin McHale, Andrew Nesbitt, Eugene Donnelly, John Lance, Brian Nelson, Cahill Curley, the list goes on. Of course, the cars and the machinery that was on it was just incredible. 160 crews, I think, made the start. And as you'll hear later on, we talked to Beatty, you know, him and Plum Tindall, as you say, were the originators of it. And a little bit later on any other business, I'll give you a bit more detail what actually happened.
Okay, we'll do that. Now, because I've probably been on holiday and I just probably still a little bit half asleep, genuinely only realised that this week and that it's turkey this week. And so I'm not going to go for the obvious pun of talking turkey, Trev. That would be such a lazy comedic way to get into talking about Rally Turkey, an event that you know a little bit about.
Yeah, I did it in 2005 with Mark Higgins as part of the production cup that we were doing that year. Stages were in a different part of Turkey, so it has moved. And as we saw last year, for the first time in this new region, it's effectively more like the Acropolis than any other gravel rallies in the championship. In other words, it's definitely going to be rough. It's going to be brutal at times, certain sections, unless they've repaired the road inside the last year. It's going to be hot and the average speed is low, which puts a lot of pressure clearly on tires, on engine breathing, and also on suspension, drivetrain and brakes, you know. So we saw plenty of incidents last year. So moving to the new region certainly brought a lot of drama. It certainly was a rally of attrition last year.
It's, you know what, when you kind of break it down like that, you don't think about it like that. As a fan, even as from the limited driving that I've done, you don't tend to think about the slower the speed, the more wear and tear, I suppose, because the cars are not really gliding over it. They are actually, it's kind of supposed, think back to, I suppose, old Safari days. Every damper is going up and down. And that sounds really obvious thing to say, but it is, isn't it? Because of the slower speed, it's actually not skirting over anything. The compressions are being felt throughout every damper.
Yeah, and it's just one of those rallies, you know, the tricky part of it is having the patience. So if you're leading at the end of the first leg, I don't think you're going to win the rally because you've driven too hard or you're driving too hard. I remember last year, I think Tanak, who won it, was sixth after the first day. There's a road position thing there. But yeah, it's going to be hard to gauge how fast to drive. But even with that, we saw incidents last year where people were just hitting rocks, or even Ogier, he had a compression, didn't even see what he hit. And if you remember back to it, that's when he broke the TCA or wishbone, and he had Elvin Evans help to fix it, and Henning Solberg stopped with him. The same stage, or maybe it was the one before at Neuville, suspension just disintegrated through the bonnet, and that effectively put him in the Super Rally. And that was the championship battle, you know. So you've got Ogier then, who got the car fixed and would on set a fastest time in the next stage. And then first stage out of service, he did probably one of the stupidest mistakes he ever made, his self-admission, where he just ran a little bit wide and got stuck and never damaged the car. And that was it. He ended up clearing the stage and driving it back to service, but rally two'd again. So it's just going to be one of those rallies where you need to stay out of trouble. Don't be surprised that like a Sunanen, Danny Sordo, are close to the head of the field on the first day with road position. Even though it did rain a little bit overnight on the Thursday night last year, it still wasn't wet enough. So the dust issues, the first loop of stages, that could be a pivotal issue as well. So there's just plenty to happen. You know, Tanak, if he's wise, he won't be going for a win there. He's got 33 points of a lead at the minute. So he just needs to stay out of trouble and get to the finish. Even in the top three, I'd take it if I was him.
Do you think that there's an interesting mindset as well, of course, that this is one of the few events that I can think of where most of the mileage happens on the first day?
Yeah.
And I just wonder whether there's, you know, from a driver's point of view at that level, is there a different mindset? Because there isn't a kind of playing your way in, is there? Not that these guys play the way in at all, but if everything's, you know, a high percentage of the mileage is happening on the Friday, does that change your approach a little bit, you know, or do you still think about it from a 2 day or 2.5 day rally as they are these days, of thinking about just road position for day two?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't looked at the itinerary to see if this midday service, and I assume there would be in a rally like this. But you're right, sometimes, and you have to do a whole leg with only a tyre change, and you have to carry the bits in the car. Potentially, your forecast might break, especially in a rough rally like this. But I don't think you'd change it. As I go back to the same thing, the difficulty is just gauging the pace. And we certainly saw last year where Ogier at one point took 18 seconds out of Neuville. So just judging the pace and going fast and the bits that you know are smooth and holding back a little bit on the rough ones. But clearly, you know, that can work, but sometimes you'll just hit a rock anyway. So you look a bit silly if you're going at a decent pace but trying to stay out of trouble and then something breaks. So, yeah, it's a fine line. It's a difficult one to gauge. That's why they get paid so much money.
Absolutely. Now, there's been things moving with regards to the championship. You mentioned, of course, Roy Tanak's lead before. The manufacturer championship, Trev, seems to be the one that is obviously shaping up quite nicely as well now, where Toyota and Hyundai are the two main protagonists in this particular championship. Hyundai, over the last couple of days, announced doing some additional events to get ready for the Spanish round it's the penultimate round. It's Spain is the penultimate round now, isn't it? Have I got that the right way round? It is, isn't it? Yeah. Rally Spain, where basically, obviously, it's one of the few events that's both tarmac and gravel, but Hyundai announcing Thierry Neuville doing Rally Legend, which obviously, of course, plays its way into tarmac, and then you've got a Spanish gravel round for Sebastian Loeb. Obviously, any particular advantage they can gain from doing those events being added into the pot to get ready for obviously the Spanish round of WRC as well. You just think, well, Hyundai seem to have been the ones doing this more than anybody else recently. I don't remember this. It's certainly over the last two, maybe 3 years, Trev, where WRC teams have kind of stepped outside of doing their normal testing program or indeed their normal WRC program, and now adding additional events with these cars.
It's a good idea because, as we've talked about before, on a test road, you've only got 4 or 5K, and that deteriorates certainly on gravel as you go over it. So yeah, if you go to a rally with the right intention to change things at each service or even get the drivers to change setups with dampers, clicks and things like that between stages, you will be able to dial the car in a lot better on an event than you will on a test. So there's certainly good value in doing it, but not every team's got the budget to do it. So Hyundai, as you say, seem to do it quite a lot. So you know, the pressure's on. The pressure's on to win the Manufacturers' Championship, especially. They're only 8 points ahead of Toyota. Toyota left this rally last year with a 1-2. So maximum manufacturers' points from them. And there's nothing to say they won't do it again if they've got this brake issue fixed, which, again, you know, it's just those small little niggles that were getting the Tannock. And he'd be putting plenty of pressure on the Toyota team as well to make sure he's got a car that can cope with the conditions. Well, and not just there, of course, for the rest of the year.
Apparently, Tom Fowler, I read an article with Tom Fowler, it was a bedding issue. Apparently, the brakes weren't bedding perhaps as well as what they would have wanted to. And it could have been there a lot longer than just Germany. It could have been the fact that Germany was the first event where there was so much stress and strain on the brakes that it really highlighted it.
Yeah, it seemed to be one corner. I think when Tannock had explained it, or certainly after the last rally, he was explaining it was one corner that was the problem with it. And I'm not sure betting will be it. I'll clearly have to take Tom Fowler's word for it. He's the engineer. But that seems to be putting the onus on the driver to make sure they do a better job at bedding the brakes in.
I've not thought about it from that point of view. But just taking a step back to Hyundai as well, and obviously doing these additional events, it'd be amiss of me to say it was down to the change in management, but obviously we have spoke before about Andrea Adama's, obviously is a very dynamic man in charge of Hyundai now, and also demanding no more mistakes from his team, obviously losing a little bit of ground in the manufacturers, and you know, from all the different things that you hear from different sources, Trev, you know, Hyundai are desperate to secure a manufacturer title, absolutely desperate.
Yeah. Without doubt, it's a big thing for them. And, you know, we've certainly seen plenty of things written that if they don't get it this year, then it could cast a shadow over whether they'll compete in the championship going forward or not. You know, that's the only speculation. I don't think there's any truth in it, but who knows? Mr. Adamo's come in and he's certainly got a brief to make sure they win that title. And he's doing everything that he sees fit to do. And, you know, some of the things they were doing at the start of the year, we were starting to question a little bit, but, you know, the proof is in the pudding. And it still is. They are still leading the Manufacturers' Championship. But certainly for the last three rallies, the Toyota is going to be very strong. If it can get reliable on this one, and it gets, you know, if Toyota can get on the podium with one car or two cars, then that will certainly keep the pressure on them. So, yeah, it's big stakes for everybody involved.
Now, we're just talking about, obviously, the runners and riders, obviously, of Hyundai and Toyota. I suppose it's worth mentioning for those who, Toyota's lineup is a given lineup, as it were. Obviously, Andreas Mikkelsen, Thierry Neuville, and Danny Sordo out on this particular event. But again, Citroën is a given. Were you surprised, because we spoke at length about this as well, about Pontus Tiedemann being announced, Trev? It feels like only a couple of weeks ago that it was announced that he would be doing Turkey. Obviously, Elvin's still missing from the M Sport lineup. You were quizzical about the events he chose at the beginning of the year. You know, obviously using that limited budget, you know, using Monte Carlo to get ready for Sweden, and you were slightly quizzical over that, which I think you would probably prove quite right. Are you surprised that he's come back on this one?
It just goes back to the same thing. If I was a team manager, I'd want to see Pontus Tiedemann's pace in a World Rally car, and Rally Turkey is not the one that you'd be watching out for that. You know, if he gets a clean run, he could end up like Henning Solberg last year, finished sixth. But what does that prove? It doesn't prove to me he's got the pace to mix it at the top. So I would be using different rallies where he can show his pace, and I don't think Turkey is the one. So again, just a surprise for me, but who's to say? I know what I'm talking about. It just doesn't to achieve the goal of getting team managers to look at him and say, wow, I don't think it's the event that he should have done, but
Again, you know, it surprised me. I look a little bit further down the leaderboard as well, and you know, a driver that came into, you know, very, very famous in the Asia Pacific series, and we spoke about him a couple of times in the past with our friends over at Rally Sport Magazine. Garvey Gill's back in WRC 2, new support, new sponsor, and everything else, driving an M Sport R5 Mark II shape as well. And again, I was surprised to see him come back. It's Cyprus. I haven't been out of, obviously, WRC since last year, really. But then again, I'm thinking, well, is there a logic behind somebody like him coming back from doing Asia Pacific and picking his way through some of those really, really rough, you know, notoriously bad rough stages that some of the Asia Pacific rounds can throw up? Is Turkey a natural event for him to come back on, perhaps, then, going the other way from what we've just said about Pontus?
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, if you've got a title sponsor and they want a bit of extra coverage, you have a good chance of getting in the top three or top five and earning that little bit more coverage on that rally than you would if you went to Finland or any of the other faster rallies, such as Spain, where you've got, you know, the Western Europeans will be flat out on that one. So, yeah, that's the flip, and that makes sense as well.
Yeah, so it's always very, very lazy that with the way we do this, and we're always pretty much hopeless at it, Trev. But would you like to hazard a guess at a top three for this coming weekend?
I'll go Neuville to win, because I don't think that Tanak should be pushing for the win. He's clearly, you know, on pace. Tanak's the man. You wouldn't go past him. But I think Neuville, he was going hard in the rally last year, and he's shown his pace there again recently. So Neuville, I'll go for Tanak at third. I think third will be enough, and we'll stick OJ in the middle, because, you know, he's gonna do something, isn't he?
Do you think?
Yeah, I think he'll be at it. You know, he's never going to give up.
No,
unless something dramatic happens in the Friday, he's going to go at it. So,
I don't think he will. But I'm less and less convinced now by the Citroen.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
And I'm not trying to talk it out of your decision, Trev. Far from it. but we probably should have done a pound in each or a euro. Well, depending on where you are in the world, even dollar each, and maybe done something with that money, because come the end of the year, someone could have been quite rich just trying to get at least one of these right. Okay, I'm gonna go the other way. Okay, I'm gonna go proper left field. This.
Oh, geez, I'm gonna go
Meek to win, and I'm going to go Danny Sordo second.
Ooh.
And I'm going to go Wojtek Tanak third.
Okay,
there you go. I like to throw a curveball, and we haven't got the other boys' choices, so they see how honest they are when we come back after our break. But yeah, that's where I'm going to go anyway. Let's see where that goes.
That'll be an interesting last day if Meek's leading the rally and Tanak's third, won't it?
It will, but will he? I don't think he'll need to do the honors at that point.
Okay.
That's just my thought. I know where you were going, because I was going to put Oi second, and I was thinking, you know, would he be team owner? I don't know. Anyway, you mentioned your any other business for this week. So I'm gonna now hand over to you for your any other business for this week, Trevor Agnew.
My any other business has to be deja vu in Donegal. Everything about that trip. I've done it again this weekend. It's just amazing. Even me driving from Kent to pick up Angus and Angus Watt, who supplied the wonderful 1974 911 that we used. Bright green, absolute crowd pleaser. Everybody loved the car. And then we left Oxfordshire at 8 o'clock on the Friday morning. Got to Donegal at 8:30 that night via the Holyhead Dublin ferry, and the party began. It was just an amazing collection of lots of people over the years. People I hadn't even met. Adrian Boyd was a driver who I always looked up to. Cathal Curley, I've never don't remember meeting him, and of course all the others that, you know, you become friends with over the years. And I worked out the last time I was actually in Donegal at a rally is 21 years ago. So it's a huge thing for us to go there, and the welcome in the hills of Donegal is just incredible. The machinery was just outstanding. Like Andrew Nesbitt, six-time winner, was in a ex-Petter Solberg 12B, I think it was, or 12C, actually. It was one of a very special number. There's only two or three of them, supplied by Enda Garvey, who has got a few different rally cars about. So he was first on the road, followed by Anthony Warrnambool, was in the passenger seat of Ackham's BMW 2002, 1975 winning car owned by the Wiley family. And then it just went on and on. Mark 1 Escorts, Mark 2 Escorts, John Lands, Austin McHale in the BMW M3 Extra Vision car. Patrick Snares was a guest of honour. He was in a Mark 2 Escort. First time ever, he's on the right-hand side of a car, right-hand drive, never driven a competition car like that. So we had to keep checking in on him as we went through, make sure he was okay. And Patrick, at 62 years of age now, absolutely loved it, smiled his face the whole weekend. And it's just that type of event, you know. It's very, very special weekend. And, of course, there's a poignancy to it as well in that we paid tribute to John Mulholland, a big contributor, as Jack mentioned, the last program to motorsport and rallying in particular in Ireland. And then, of course, Manus Kelly, who lost his life in the international rally this year. And on the Fanad stage, we stopped. We set up a little memorial at the crash site, and the whole convoy stopped, and the family were there and a few friends, and with a service with the Reeve Lane, and it was just a special moment on that stage, you know. And I ended up meeting his family later on in Remelton when we were waiting. You know, that's just a guy who I'd never met, but was a legend at Donegal, three times winner the last 3 years, and just that's how it all, you know, it all morphs into one with a gala dinner in the evening. Which Andrew Nesbitt was auctioneering, and it just, the money it was raised through photographs, as you can imagine, is quite a spirited chap. And again, just the charity element of it comes through every time. But from the moment we arrived to the moment we left, just the level of organisation, the welcome we got, and I'd highly recommend it to anybody of any part of the world just to come over. There's plenty of places you can hire a car if you want a competition car, you want something a bit special, even just a road car. You know, we went through Remelton, following a Vauxhall Cavalier, a Mark 1 Cavalier. the committee in Remelton had closed the town off. We had like a regroup on the Harbour Arm with lots of interviews, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people. And big congrats to the organisers, Plum Tyndall, Billy Crawford, and everybody involved in it. And again, just the poignancy and the amount of money that they've raised for charity, I'd highly recommend everybody to go to. Well, and of course, later on, as you say in the programme, there's so many absolute rally listeners, and the encouragement, thank you to all you. You know who you are. I don't want to miss somebody out. So, thanks for the encouragement. I'm certainly passed it on to Jack and Ryan, of course, Tony. Of course, the flip side of that was Jack had a horrible weekend, and our thoughts were definitely with him.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just the two sides of the coin, really, and him doing his job reporting for Formula 2 and Grand Prix, and that could not have been an easy event for him. So, thoughts are with him when we find out that bad news.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Well said. Obviously, Trev's just been talking about deja vu. We have got BT Crawford coming up, some fantastic stories as well. Just very, very briefly, and something else that's coming up later in the podcast. My end of the business this week was the first closed road event we've had in Wales, and the organising team behind it. What did we call it before, Trev? Because we were debating the best way of being a non-Welsh person pronunciating this.
I think it's the Cardigan Bay Rally. We'll go with that.
Cardigan Bay Rally. There you go. Sounds right. Rally Bay, which was obviously the big hashtag thing that they put out there. And the team that have put that together, I know Phil Pugh and, you know, various other people have been behind it as well. And Damien Cole, who, of course, you'll know from competing, but also obviously is the title sponsor of the event. I've heard nothing but amazing things about the event, and we're going to have the event winner coming up a little later on the podcast, Ocean Price, who's been, unfortunately, not been in a rally car that much over the last few months for various reasons, budget free and unfortunately due to an injury as well. But it was his first event back, and a very, very proud Welshman winning the first proper closed road Welsh tarmac rally as well, so we'll talk to Oshan a little bit later on. But Trev and I are going to have a little break, we'll have a cup of tea, and after this break we'll come back with BT Crawford.
This is Absolute Rally.
Absolute Rally continues to be partnered by the Kielder Works team, who remain fully committed to the sport and are pioneers of the latest technology. Kielder cordless tools are tailored for all forms of competitive action.
Go back to the future with the Kielder Works team.
Welcome back to Absolute Rally, and welcome to, we're going to have a bit of, well, I suppose you could say we always have legends on this programme, but we've got a bit of a special legend who Trevor Agnew and I are going to be talking to very, very shortly. You may have seen some of the fantastic images that came out from the Deja Vu event, which obviously Trev was part of, which we talked about briefly at the top of the programme. We wanted to save it specifically for this because we've got one of the people behind it. BT Crawford, welcome to Absolute Rally for the first time.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate being invited, and hopefully we can have a nice chat about a few things.
Well, there's plenty to go at, and I'll be honest with you, I've wanted to get you on for some time. It was suggested by one or two other people, but it was Trev who kind of took me by the scruff of the neck and said, we've got to get BT on. So at this point, I feel that Trevor, let go of me by the scruff of the neck and please take it away.
Well, we Northern Irish people look after one another.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have somebody on the show that's actually been rallying longer than me, because it's usually me as the elder statesman, BD. But like me, I think you started rallying all those years ago before you'd even a driving license. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, well, I don't quite understand where this rallying thing came from in our family, because my father was a milkman, and the only thing he drove for 50 years was a horse and cart. My mother had no interest in cars at all. I don't think she ever got her driving license. So it was my brother, Esler, who became, you know, quite well known through both rallying and photography, better known probably from photography, despite the fact that he won the Circuit of Ireland navigating for Adrian Boyd. But my brother first got the bug, and what we did, my father eventually ended up owning a Ford Zephyr 6. And we went out in these Larne Motor Club rallies, but in those days they were more like treasure hunts. So we, together with Robert Woodside, who, you know, became Kima Autotest, the three of us went, and I hadn't even my driving license, and I sat in the back seat of this Ford Zephyr. No seat belts. You know, it was just a standard, normal car. My father thought we were on a treasure hunt. But so that's how it all started. I think I was probably about 16, something like that.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. So that led on to a few more adventures, particularly with Derek Boyd. I think that's when the serious rallying started, in the early 60s.
Yeah, well, you know, it was all navigation in those days, and I discovered two things. I was good at reading maps. I wasn't much of a driver, so I was far better off in the co-driver seat navigating. And of course, navigating, you have to get a lot of experience in navigating. So gradually, I probably navigated for 100 different people in my life. And I gained experience, and eventually Derek asked me to go with him in the Circuit of Ireland. And we almost won that event. That was the one at Esther and Ian Woodside. We were fighting for the lead, and this was our first ever event in the circuit. Until the very last evening, I still remember it to my dying day. We came to a Y junction. I told Derek to go left. Esther went right. He was right. We ended up at the control, wrong approach, so we lost a lot of marks. Anyway, we finished, we won the Novice Award. I think we finished about ninth overall.
Wow, and that was way back in 1964. Very good year, that one, actually. There's a lot of good things happened that year. Yeah. So then you went on to learn from it, though. So carrying on through the 60s and into the early 70s, you had a lot of success in the Circuit of Ireland. That's when it was a proper rally as well, five-day event.
Well, Adrian Boyd, Derek's brother, invited me to navigate for him, because his regular navigator, Morris Johnson, began to suffer from car sickness and had to give it up. So Adrian asked me to co-drive for him, and I was with Adrian for about 10 or 11 years. And Adrian was, in my opinion, one of the greatest ever Irish rally drivers, underappreciated. But we finished second twice in the circuit, third twice, and we won it in 1971.
But Adrian was good on a track as well, wasn't he? He wasn't just a rally driver. He was equally as quick on hill climbs and
touring cars. Adrian could drive anything. Autotest, he represented Northern Ireland in the Autotest, the Ken Horton driving test. He hill climbed, he raced a Sprite at Kyrgyzstan, and he raced a 3-litre Capri at Ingolstadt. And Adrian, he was a modern rally driver for those days. He was so smooth. He was one of the few rally drivers that I know who actually looked at the rev counter before the days of rev limiters, when you had to look at rev counters. He actually looked at his rev counter and still beat everybody else. He was a brilliant driver.
It was an absolute pleasure to meet him last weekend as well, because clearly he's a household name in Irish motorsport. Anybody's interested will remember Adrian Boyd, and of course you sitting alongside him. But, you know, the competition was fairly hard in the early 70s. You know, people like Paddy Hopkirk, Roger Clark.
Well, yeah, they would have been our two major competitors. And we never beat either of them. We finished second to Paddy and second to Roger in the circuit. Adrian did, you know, after I went to America for a year in 1973, stayed for 35, but Adrian beat Roger in the Manx Rally with John Davenport co-driving. I think Roger retired. So they certainly were our two major competitors at that time. Of course, there were a whole host of good Irish drivers as well, but I would say Paddy and Roger were obviously the two major competitors.
Mm-hmm. Well, that car you were using then was an X-Works BDA Mark I Escort. That must have been a hell of a machine when you got into that the first time.
The year we won the circuit was not an X-Works car. That was just a standard. It wasn't a BDA, it was a twin cam, and we were up against Chris Slater, who had a BDA.
Right.
And that was just a twin cam. Later on, because we were sponsored by Ari Hamilton, and they were a major Ford dealership in Belfast, so they had very good connections with Borum, and they persuaded the Borum then, after we won the circuit in 71, to provide Adrian with an X-Works car.
Right. So the 72 and 73 was in an X-Works BDA then.
Yeah, well, we couldn't, if you want to hear a good story, we couldn't compete in the circuit in 72 because it was cancelled. So Robert Taylor, who was sort of the team manager, decided we should go to Sweden and compete in the Swedish rally. And we went in a Ford Mexico. We put half a four studded tires in the roof rack and drove over in a Ford Mexico to Mexico, to Sweden. Of course, it all snow and ice and Adrian, no experience. So it's just a bit of, I think Robert Taylor liked the circuit of Ireland 71. A whole host of Swedes came over and brought their girlfriends with their hot pants. So I think Robert decided we better go to Sweden. So we finished, I think, 23rd overall or something. We didn't, you know. So the prize giving was being held. And halfway through the prize giving, I heard my name being called, B.D. Crawford. I didn't do anything. We hadn't won anything, so nobody else went up to the stage, and sort of silence, and heard my name again, B.D. Crawford. And then the service crew said, "B.D., that's you going up." So I decided I better walk up to the stage. And I arrived on the stage, and there was this lady holding a huge bunch of red roses. And B.D. Crawford had won the ladies' award.
Excellent.
I'm not sure who was more red, the roses, the lady, or me.
Brilliant. What a great story.
They thought I was a woman, you see, because of my name, Beattie.
Of course. Well, Pat Moss could have been mistaken the other way as well, couldn't she, at some point? But then 73, you said you went to America and you didn't come back for 35 years. So that effectively ended the first stint of your co-driver. Why did you go there?
I actually came back and did a few rallies with Adrian. And we should have, well, we should have, would have, could have. You know, that's rallying. We should have won the 73 circuit, 73. And we were just struggling at home and David Wood engine through a Conroe rod in Havana about 5 o'clock on Tuesday morning, and it was our rally over in Jack Torda, one that was still short that year in the Porsche.
That was 74, yeah.
And I think I was 74. When you get to my age, 73 and 74 don't make a difference.
So what work took you to the States, is that right? If you just explain what you do and why you went over there, that'd be good.
Well, I'm a medical doctor, and I trained in radiology, so I became a consultant radiologist in Belfast, but I had no, and this was a very specific form of radiology, pediatric radiology, which is a subspecialty. But I had very, very little experience in pediatric, it's radiology of children, a pediatric radiology, so I decided I would go to the States and was lucky enough to receive a fellowship at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore for a year. And after 6 months, I decided I liked America. So I stayed for another year and another year until 35 years come up and decided, America's great, but, you know, Northern Ireland's better.
Right. And then you go back into the rallying again.
Well, I persuaded Aaron Vagel, Adrian, to come over with his Renault Alpine, and we did the Canadian winter in the Alpine. I think we finished fourth, and we also did the rally called the Criterion de Quebec, and we retired. But basically after that, I didn't rally, you know, for years, and I still get my motoring news every week sent over from the UK. I still followed rallying avidly, but I had to work too hard in America. You don't earn a lot of money if you don't work hard there. Mm-hmm. So I really didn't compete then for a long time. And then one evening in the late 80s, I got a phone call from Adrian. He said, "Petey, how would you like to do a classic car rally?" And I thought, "Oh, what's a class? I never heard of a classic car rally." Mm-hmm. I said, "It's just the same as we used to do." I said, "Okay." So this was the Pirelli Rally Marathon. So we did this at Adrian's Daimler SP, 240, the Daimler Dart. Mm-hmm. And we finished, I think, 14th overall. The problem was that I was well and truly rebitten by the bug. And uh-huh. God, that was the best thing I've done for 35 years. I better get started again. So it went up.
That became a bit more expensive, though, from the co-driver side of things.
Well, by that time, I could afford, I mean, when I was a medical student, I had no money. I mean,
yeah.
So I had to sit with whoever asked me to go with them in a rally. But I'd earned some money by that time in the States, so I decided, you know, I really like that. So I bought a Mini Cooper, asked Adrian if he would do the Pirelli Classic with me, and he decided no, he didn't want to. So I thought, well, who will I get to drive? Well, Ronnie McCartney was the obvious choice. Talked to Ronnie. Ronnie said, sure, of course. We got Mervyn Johnson to build an engine for us and Rob Poliganoma to do the body. And we arrived at the start in London up against Roger Clark and Timo McAdam, Yves Van Lennep. And we went out and won the thing.
Well, Stirling Moss, I think, was doing that year as well, wasn't it?
Sterling was there and pranged his Healy. Sterling was in a Healy 3000. Mm-hmm. I pranged it in one of the stages. And so that was one of my. It wasn't easy, but we won. That was the main thing.
I remember it well. It was a big, big celebration after that one. Maybe not as big as when Hopkirk won Monte Carlo. But,
yeah. As you know, Paddy is one of my favorite people in the whole world. I think he's a brilliant guy. Best driver ever to come out of Ireland, in my opinion.
Yeah, and he can tell a good story as well.
Paddy Hopkirk was multi-talented. You know, Paddy has it all, not just good driver, but, you know, he's 360 round and he's just a brilliant man.
Yeah. So then that led you to pick ex-world champions and celebrity drivers to drive, not just the Mini, but then when the Mini wasn't competitive, you moved up to a 911.
Well, yeah, because I asked Dick Bloomquist to drive for me in the
car. As you do.
Pardon?
As you do.
Well, in those days, you know, for some reason they all said yes. I don't know why. And we finished fourth in that, Anderson, I think, won in the 911. It was quite obvious a Mini couldn't compete against the 911. So I bought a 911 that Ronnie McCartney had rallied a bit and had gone off in Balaclava, and it was a bit damaged, but I bought it and asked Francis Tuttle, who knows everything about Porsches, to look after the car. So that was just a standard 65 911. It wasn't a rally car. It was a roll cage in it and some guard. But we were very successful in that car. And then Bjorn Valdegaard drove it, and Billy Coleman drove it, and Jimmy McRae, and they all loved that car. It was brilliant. I mean, that 65 Porsche was an incredibly before its time car. It's just absolutely amazing car.
And then later on, you were into Walter Rohrl and Minari also driving for you, Sandra and Minari?
Yeah, I mean, Sandra and I had... Sandra's English wasn't that great, and my Italian was non-existent, so it was quite an interesting experience. And we went off in the third or fourth stage in Ypres, and that was that. Walter, Walter is just brilliant, and we won, well, we unofficially won the REC Charrington that year, but we were disqualified because of a very minor, don't know what you would call it. It wasn't illegal, but the stewards thought it was illegal, pardon the front suspension. It was certainly something we didn't even know anything about.
Yeah.
But it's life.
Quite incredible. What a history of co-driving. But then that led in 2014 to come up with the idea of what was later on, I suppose, the Deja Vu event. So the first one I remember was in Killarney in 2016. In fact, apart from last weekend, the last time I was chatting to you was when we did the all live stream for the Circuit of Ireland that year, and you were telling us about it. So just if you want to just tell people about Deja Vu and how that came about.
Basically, it all started from the Paddy Hopkirk Gala. As I say, I'm a major admirer of Paddy. And in 2013, I was sitting one day and I thought, you know, Paddy won the Monte Carlo Rally. It'll be 50 years next year. So, you know, we really should do something for him. So I talked to Paddy and he was all keen. And I got a crew together, Cahill Curley, Con Williamson, Plum Tyndall, Alan Plum Tyndall, and myself. And we formed a committee. And we put on this gala. It was an all-day event, started at Stormont, down into the center of Belfast, where the police closed the Royal Avenue for us. And we had a visit. The Lord Mayor gave Paddy a little memento of the occasion, and then we ended up down to Titanic. And we had 540 people for dinner, and we made £55,000 for charity for the Integrated Education Fund for Northern Ireland. I'm a great believer in integrated education, by the way. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge success. And then I thought, I don't know, I don't quite understand myself how I come up with the idea, but I thought, you know, why don't we organize an event that, you know, retraces the roots over special stages of the past in Killarney, down in Kerry or Donegal or Torhead. I come up with this idea, and I spoke to Plum about it, and Plum was all keen. I come up with the name Deja Vu, and that was basically how it started.
Fantastic. So you've had events in Killarney. You actually won Sicily as well. Belfast last year, which brought us up to Donegal this year. And the hills of Donegal is no better place for a welcome, and what a welcome we had last weekend.
Well, the people in Donegal are special, aren't they? I mean... Killarney, it's been a learning process for us as organizers, and it's been a learning process for people out there who are interested in rallying. Initially when the people, the drivers hear about it, we're not that interested. And then, you get them out in the event, you get people like Andrew Nesbitt or Awesome Hill, and you put them in a car, and suddenly something happens. I mean, I don't know what it is. And they love it. I mean, and it's just a tour over the stages. And so the spectators have been increasing every year, as you saw yourself. I mean, Remelton was like the old days. I mean, it's amazing. It amazed me. I couldn't believe it.
It was an incredible atmosphere right from the moment we arrived. I remember Rory Kennedy was stood outside the reception hall. We got there about 8:30 on Friday night, and he said, "You're not going to believe who's in there." And sure enough, you go in, and all my heroes from Donegal from all those years ago, and more latterly, the like of Andrew Nesbitt, Eugene Donnelly, all those winners there, all just having a great time, all partaking on the black amnesia liquid stuff. And also the love for Absolute Rally over there, which I was blown away with. I'm not going to name anybody because I'll probably forget some people, but it was great from that perspective as well, that we've got to love. And again, it just goes back to this thing that people love rallying, and it's a sport that's always kept people together. But along the way, you've raised a fair few pounds for charity as well, BT.
Well, I think we're probably up to £130,000. We haven't worked out exactly what we made in Donegal, but we'll have made quite a lot of money, and it's all going to the Donegal Hospice. We personally don't take any money out of it.
Yeah, but
it's all the Donegal Hospice. And last year, we've donated to the Irish Cancer Society and to Marie Curie, people like that. Worthwhile charity. So it's, it just gives me and Plum great pleasure in people seeing, everyone enjoying themselves. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, and there's a big team of people there helping you along the way, which, a lot of people from the Donegal Motor Club, friends that I've known for close to 40 years now, and even just some marshals out in the stages was unbelievable as well. So that was...
We had huge support, the Remelton Festival Committee. I don't want to get into mentioning names, because once you mention one name...
That's the problem.
you don't know where to stop, and somebody doesn't get mentioned. So all I can say is a big thank you to everyone who supported us, and there were literally hundreds of people who helped us out.
Yeah, on behalf of the 160 or so odd crews that were there, and some spectacular cars, which I'll talk about, I've talked about this at the top of the program, so... From our point of view, thanks very much for doing it and coming up with the idea in the first place. May it continue. I hope you still got the enthusiasm and passion. I'm sure you've got plans in place for next year already, but I definitely recommend anybody, it doesn't need to be a competition car, anything that you think is valid to drive over some of the classic stages, get yourself signed up for it and don't miss it. This is the first time I've been able to do it because of work commitments, but I'll certainly find a way of doing it next year, and it's a credit to you, BD Plum, and the rest of the team.
Well, everybody's welcome. We'd love to see some more English crews coming over, Scottish crews, Welsh crews, because I think they'll really enjoy it, and it's worth the trip over, like you and Angus did this year. I think they would have a brilliant time. We would love to see them. We're quite friendly over in Ireland, as you know.
We definitely are. Biddy, thanks very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
This is Absolute Rally.
Quarter, middle and crest, 8-6 right, minus, tightens over jump, opens over 15, sharp left, tightens 5-6 up left crest, over 17, 5 right.
Ireland's leading commercial note supplier, Killian Duffy, has joined forces with 2016 British Rally champion Craig Parry to form On The Pace Note UK. For more information, visit the website onthepacenote.co.uk.
Welcome back to the next section of Absolute Rally. And Trevor and I were speaking about it at the top of the programme. We were unsure of the pronunciation. So I thought, well, I'm going to get some training from the man who won the rally. So Rally by Ceredigion, the inaugural winner of it was Ossian Price. Welcome back to Absolute Rally, Osh.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's obviously there's loads of little stories. I love when there's loads of little stories. We've just been, before we started recording, I've just been asking about obviously your health. You unfortunately had a fall on a mountain bike over in France 6 weeks ago now, and obviously that put paid to some of your other rally plans. And then obviously it was the first time you drove the car and everything else. So first and foremost, how is your health? How are you feeling after the rally?
No, the health's been good, to be honest. I've been quite lucky to have a lot of help from some great people, and they've kind of put me in good shape for the rally. And, you know, post-rally, I mean, everything's looking just as a normal day, really. So I'm quite happy with that. I was expecting a few aches and pains during the rally, but, you know, everything went along as planned. Just a little bit of discomfort, and that was it. So, yeah, can't ask for more, to be honest.
Now, before we talk about the rally itself, because obviously being a proud Welshman, it must have been an amazing feeling to win that rally with all the expectation and all the media attention around it as well. But how soon or how long did you know you were going to be doing the rally in that car, for instance, and things like that? How did that deal come about?
It was a strange one, really. I spoke to Malwyn Evans about having a car for the event when the sort of build-up was happening. This was obviously a long time before I decided to go and have an accident on my mountain bike. But yeah, we just left it very open-ended, really. And I said, you know, is there something we can do? And, you know, he came up with a deal and nothing was said over the next couple of weeks. And obviously I had to ring him then. The week that I fell off my bike and say, look, this is the situation and I'm still planning to do the event, but I'll give you a 2 week window before the rally. So that gave me sort of 4 weeks to kind of get to a certain level of recovery. And yeah, I made a decision sort of 4 weeks in that I was going to do the rally and go ahead with everything. So I think everybody was still sort of thinking I was mad at that point, but I was kind of gauging my sort of recovery on how the previous weeks had been, and that's how it happened. So yeah, we had a test on the car the week of the rally on the Wednesday. We did a couple of miles, and straight away, as soon as I got in the car and did a few miles, it was a massive relief for me, because it could have all gone very wrong there, really. I wasn't comfy and happy in the car in terms of the shoulder, then we would have probably had to stop everything. But yeah, that would, you know, that day was very crucial and gave me a bit of confidence, really, to think, you know, you can do this, and I didn't really turn back.
Was it the right side, if that makes sense? Because obviously there's one arm that does a hell of a lot of work, and there's the other arm that doesn't. I'm trying to remember the picture of you with your arm in a sling and which way round you'd be in the car. So was it the gear change arm? It wasn't, was it? It was the other side.
It was the gear change arm.
Oh, was it? Jeez. I didn't realise it was. I thought it was the other side. So with a sequential gearbox, it's had a proper workout, hasn't it?
It's had a good workout. But I mean, I've been driving my left-hand driver recce car for weeks on end now, just to try and, you know, get some movement in the arm. I mean, there was time where I couldn't drive for a couple of weeks, and then I decided to sort of just do what I could. And that helped, really. But obviously when you're pulling on the gear lever and pulling on the handbrake and stuff like that, that was my biggest concern, really, because, you know, it's so physical, really. And especially in that car, you can't change gear quick enough. So there's always a lot going on. But I think in hindsight, it might have been lucky that it was that side, because, you know, there's a hell of a lot of force going through your arm when you're trying to steer one of these things as well. So at least, worst case, I could just keep one hand on the gear lever and steer with my other arm. But, you know, I never got to that, luckily.
Now, if we can get to the events, it took me back to perhaps an era that hasn't been, it hasn't been forgotten, but it kind of has. And I think it was a great era. And I'm talking about your battles with Tom Cave back in BRC days and the DS3s, to be honest with you. There was proper hammer and tongue back then. And it kind of just, it was like somebody had just pressed play again after it had been on pause for a couple of years.
Yeah, to be honest, it did feel like that, like halfway through the event, because at the beginning I was still a bit apprehensive, and I had a plan to sort of get through the first stage and give it sort of 70%, and if they were sort of ahead, Tom was ahead, I would go, well, you know, he's going to be ahead because I'm on 70% plus his experience, which I think he was nearly 2 seconds, you know, nearly 2 seconds out of us on the first stage, and I was like, oh, there's plenty more to give here. So after that then, you know, I was at ease really and put the hammer down, and, you know, we managed to take some time out of him. So at this point, I really wasn't thinking of what was going on, but I mean, Bex Williams made it clear before I went into service that I was valley leading. Before you knew it, it was a bit of a surreal feeling, really, considering what had happened in the previous weeks. But yeah, that was just the beginning of, you know, what was going to be a decent battle in the afternoon. You know, we were very close on, you know, within a second on two stages, and yeah, luckily the event ended up in my favour.
You've done, you know, the DMAC Drive Trophy. Obviously, you've done British Rally Championship, you know, repeatedly as well. These stages, how did they stack up? How did they compare? I've heard lots of things that, you know, I've heard, you know, very similar to Ulster in certain parts, a bit like, you know, some of the inroads on the Manx, you know, very, very bumpy, very twisty, very challenging. What did you liken it to?
It's a job to compare it, really. I mean, there's bits that are similar, like you say, to your Manx, your Ulster, but it's almost a unique kind of thing again, you know. The road characteristics, yeah, have their own sort of character in terms, really. I couldn't really compare them to anything. It was just like, you know, such a surreal feeling that, you know, 30 minutes from my hometown, that, you know, I'm doing a rally on these roads that, you know, people in the road rallying world always rave about, really. And yeah, I mean, just the fact that they were so busy and there was no let off in them, you know what I mean? You're doing sort of a loop of 22 odd miles, and it felt like you'd done double that. So yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, there's hints of, you know, comparison to Manx and Ulster. But yeah, it was quite unique from what I felt anyway.
It felt like leading up to it, you were obviously distracted quite rightly with obviously trying to get yourself fit for it. But from the outside looking in to the events itself, it felt like, you know, there's the right people at the top of that event. I think it's fair to say, you know, people like Phil Pugh and people like that. And it just had this feeling that this is going to be special. And I don't say this lightly. I think we've seen possibly the first real special event that could kind of stand the test of time in terms of closed road rallying.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you've got three guys at the top. Wayne, who's obviously a former clerk of the course of the Midwell stages, so his knowledge is obviously second to none, really. And, you know, having worked again with Phil Pugh, who's obviously second in command, Phil's a very experienced guy, and he's done an awful lot of rallies, as has Andrew Edwards again, you know. So you put the three of them together and, you know, mix in another whole team of organization that as well has seen all kinds of rallying on different levels, on different drivers, different countries. You've just got the perfect team, really. And, you know, they're all an enthusiastic bunch. They're all competitors, pretty much. So they know what we as competitors want. And, you know, the hardest thing, I guess, is just keeping everybody happy, because it's clearly a new thing to us in Wales here. But, you know, obviously from the feedback they've had, I mean, it's phenomenal, really. And, you know, hats off to the effort they've put in. And, I mean, I feel sorry for their families a little bit. I'm sure that there's barely seen any of them in the last sort of 12 months. But, yeah, hats off to them. And, yeah, they should be very, very proud of what they've achieved.
What was the welcoming like for you? Because obviously you have competed all over the world as well. And what was the welcome like from the fans' point of view and the locals and stuff like that? Because that's critical, isn't it, when something gets brought out like this? You know, you've got to have the local people. We all know, we've all been on rallies where this is a PR sensitive area, or this, you've got to, watch your noise here, and they'll have, a jugs your fact there or whatever. What were your experiences of what you were seeing out, on the road sections and stuff like that?
To be fair, I mean, there was people out everywhere. I mean, we had very little road mileage, to be honest. So we were constantly in a stage somewhere. So, from a driver point of view, that's great. Limited road miles, compact little routes, it worked really well. But where there was road sections, or where there was, like Scrutineer, for example, was on the seafront in Aberystwyth, there was a whole ruck of people there, just to come and see the cars. Normally that's not something that people go and see. And to be fair, they did a great job of bringing the rally to the people. And I think they can still improve on that. And I think they know, but I think they were apprehensive as well, possibly with how everything's going to go and how people are going to receive all this. So I think, as far as I know, everything's gone to plan with them from that side, but yeah, the reception that they had locally was massive. I went out for a meal in Aberystwyth on Saturday night before the event, and everywhere was packed out. So, it obviously brings a lot to the area, and, everybody received it very well.
Brilliant. Now, you've been missing for a while. I'm assuming this has whetted the appetite. What's happening next, mate?
Well, in terms of RFI stuff, I'm not really sure, but I'm actually jumping back in the Escort for this weekend. We're heading to Belgium on Wednesday. So, jumping back to do the Escort Rally Special, which we won the historic event.
Of course, yeah.
So, me and my partner Jess will be doing that again this year in a Rally Extreme Escort, the same car we used last year. So, yeah, looking forward to a weekend of fun and enjoyment, really. So other than that, things are quiet. But, the winter's kind of winter prep can already start for me, as I haven't got much to concentrate on. And hopefully we can wheel something out into a championship or an event at the beginning of next year.
Brilliant. Listen, we'll keep everything crossed for you. But I just wanted to get you on, firstly, to congratulate you, and obviously to make sure you were okay, not too sore afterwards. So, listen, thanks so much for joining us, mate, and many, many congratulations on being the first name on a trophy, which I think we'll have many on it in years to come.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Folks, we'll be back after this break.
This is Absolute Rally.
Whether it's the pressures of service or an issue out on the stages, it's vital to have the right equipment to hand. Kielder cordless tools are tailored for the world of motorsport and are being used throughout all forms of competition.
Go back to the future with the Kielder Works team.
Hello everyone, welcome to the final section of Absolute Rally, episode 10, season 17. You made it right to the end of this episode, and we've saved something a little bit different, I suppose. I'll be honest, I've never done a chat, an interview, whatever you want to call it, whatever we do here, whatever title you want to give it. I've never done anything like this before. So VHS rallies, who you've probably seen it. We've shared the videos around, people are loving it. And I wanted to really talk to them. I really wanted to get them on. Now, they wanted to rename Anonymous, which is fine, but that makes doing an interview or a chat, whatever you want to call it, really, really tricky. Anyway, we came up with a solution, and the solution was I would send some questions and they would email back their responses. Now, of course, I could read it out. That would sound a bit flat. So just to kind of give us some light and shade, Alistair, our producer, who you've never heard before, so you'll hear him for the first time as well. He's the guy who kind of shines up the podcast and makes it all lovely and everything else. He will be voicing the answers. So you'll get to hear Alistair for the first time anyway. And that's not entirely true, because Alistair does do some of our voiceovers as well. So that's not entirely true. But you'll hear him, not with any sound effects behind him. There you go. So without further ado, as I say, this is the strangest piece I think I've ever recorded in 10 years of doing podcasts. In a good way, it's different. So it's always very challenging. So we'll start off with our first question. And our first question was, so what you're doing, we think, at Absolute Rally, and I think all the rally fans, is amazing. Why now?
Quite simply because time is running out. I mean, let's take something like an early grandstand or World of Sport report. How many people had the money to have a recorder in 1982? And of those, how many were around at that point on a Saturday afternoon to tape 18 minutes of rallying? Of those, how many kept the recording and didn't tape over it? I mean, tape used to be expensive, especially in the early days. And of those tapes that were recorded, how many are still in playable condition? There definitely must be some reports or recordings where we're into single-digit numbers of remaining tapes. And as for commercial tapes, even some of them are very rare. The VTV collection that I've got a couple of on the YouTube channel, those were produced in fairly small numbers and sold at a relatively high price. So again, we're talking hundreds produced, not thousands. And of those, probably only a handful remain. And if they've been left in an attic for 20 years, they might not be playable anyway because VHS tapes hate cold, damp conditions. So in a lot of cases, I think this could be the last chance saloon for these reports and recordings. That's why I've spent the best part of 2 years and four figures getting the equipment together and learning the techniques to try and get the best out of them. To give you an idea, a half hour of footage takes half an hour to capture because it has to be done in real time, and then another 3 hours of computer processing to retouch and get the best quality. Factor in a final half hour of me adding graphics and making sure the colour balance is right, and you're up to 4 hours, and that's for every 30 minutes. In the beginning, it was all off the radar just for a few mates, but then I started thinking that there must be other stuff out there that needs saving. So the public face of VHS rallies, the YouTube channel, the Twitter account, and now there's a Facebook page at fb.me/sidewaysaved, is just to publicise that, really, and to encourage people to root around and dig out the old tapes. There's a belief in some parts that the uploads I do are all from my own collection, and that's nonsense. I'm just someone who helps people to save their own recordings, and what appears on the YouTube channel and Facebook page is just a bit of promotion, nothing else. I'm happy when people like it and share it themselves, but only because it might prompt someone else to get involved.
It's important for you to remain anonymous. Why is that important? Why don't you want people to know who you are?
I'd much rather not. I'd rather be sitting there talking to you normally, but I have to be realistic and accept that sharing content like that is not legal. I'm not making money out of this, quite the opposite when you factor in the amount of kit I've bought and how much time I spend on it. But I'm not interested in eating someone else's dinner. So if a report is available digitally somewhere else, that is if it's been monetized, then I don't share it. Simple. Pay your $4.99 to Duke or Motorsport Network or whoever for the download because they've done the right thing and saved that recording. And where possible, I've tracked down original copyright holders to ask them if it's okay to share the recordings. Paul Hargreaves, who did a lot of the early VTV stuff, was pleased that someone got in touch with him because he himself doesn't have copies of his early work. But there's plenty of other stuff that I'm sharing now that someone could take exception to 5 years down the line. And I'd rather they did that with VHS Rallies, the channel, rather than me personally.
Can you tell our listeners where the passion comes from for the coverage from yesteryear?
Well, I've been a rally fan since I was about 5 years of age, I suppose. I've always preferred it to circuit racing just because of the variety of cars, technical solutions and conditions. And I'm old enough to remember a time when you did go down to the video store and rent rally videos to sit and watch with your mates. I guess you'd all just sit around a mobile phone these days.
Do you have a favourite period yourself?
Probably 1981 to 1986. I'm not a huge fan of the early Group A years, but some of the reports I've converted have really switched me on to the early 90s stuff, like Legacy RSs, Sierra Cosworth 4x4s and Escort Cosworths, and ST165 Celica GT4s. They look and sound great. I also love F2 kit cars. I wish some French fans would start digging out videos from their national championship so I could convert lots of Clio and 306 Maxis.
Do you think the current generation of fans will have a love for what we're witnessing in the current era of WRC?
That's a hard question. Modern world rally cars are so capable that the speeds are ludicrous, way in excess of what we've seen before. The drivers are incredible. And yet we see huge jumps on pretty much every rally and the cars just take it without complaint. There's no way you could have done that even 15 years ago. A Lancer or a Corolla would have spat you into the nearest hedge. So I don't know if there's the same appreciation for the driver talent. You have to look beyond the cars to really see it. Does that mean people won't watch it in 30 years? I don't know.
What do you think of current rally coverage?
It's great. I'm a WRC Plus subscriber and I frequently lose most of a Saturday or Sunday to following what's going on. There's often a tab open in my browser at work on a Friday as well. There's a great broadcasting team there, many of whom have been following WRC themselves for a long time, and it shows. It's not perfect. Technical issues sometimes get in the way, but when you see what we had in, say, 1986, and then you look at the ability to follow pretty much every corner live, regardless of where it is in the world, that's an amazing achievement, and long may it continue.
Is there footage you personally haven't been able to find and you would like to try and save?
Yeah, the next tape. I mean, I love it when people send me their pictures of their collections and there's something there that I haven't seen before or that I know is rare. And the best ones of all are the home-recorded mixtapes with handwritten labels. It's great when material turns up that I didn't even know existed. And there's plenty of that. Stuff like the old 555 promo report on the 1993 Rally of Thailand, or one that turned up recently from someone via Facebook, the 1987 Hong Kong Beijing Rally with Ari and Stig in Sierra XR 4x4s and Bjorn Waldegard in one of the big Supras. I know a lot of people on the YouTube channel have been pleased to see the British Championship reviews from the 90s, which is good because they've never been made available in digital format. But real oddities like that Thailand one, which has a really young Bernsey in it, are exciting to find and save. I suppose I'd love some of the people from the early days who are sitting on lots of recordings to maybe consider giving me a collection to convert for them. And who knows, maybe some of it could be shared. But the most important thing is that it would be saved. There are guys like Alistair Miller of AMTV who did tons of stuff and who doesn't seem to sell it anymore. I'd love to know whether he has converted his old tapes, and if he hasn't, whether he'd consider letting me save his legacy for him. In an ideal world, wouldn't it be great if rally fans all chipped into a crowdfund and bought some of these collections and the copyright so they could be shared by everyone? Equally, there are people who've contacted me asking them if I want to swap tapes because they are collectors sitting on literally hundreds of them, most of them unconverted. They mistakenly think I've got a hoard of stuff myself. I'd much rather they just looked at what they've got, worked out what they have, and then asked me to help them convert it. I did wonder as well about Plum Tyndale's collection. Seriously, that's a huge amount of great Irish footage going back through a golden era there. But now that he's retired, he sold the RPM archive to Motorsport Ireland, I understand, and nobody seems to know what's going to happen with it. Again, I just hope it's not going to sit in crates in a cold, dark room somewhere in Dublin.
What does the future hold for VHS rallies?
I've been working my way through a collection of about 140 tapes that someone gave me. And after that, I have probably another couple of dozen backed up, plus some more people who have contacted me beyond that. In a few weeks, I'm being allowed into a room that contains about 500 tapes. So we'll see what I bring out of there. There's content backed up and ready to go live on YouTube through until the end of the year. After that, who knows? As I said before, VHS rallies is a service, not me plundering a video vault of my own. If people keep offering tapes, then I'll keep doing it. If they don't, then my poor computer will get a rest. It spends most of its life, almost every minute, processing video anyway. I'll only be upset if someone waits until 2028 and then contacts me because they've got 30 VHS tapes and it turns out that the damp has ruined them. Then I'll cry.
And the last question for our own Trevor Agnew. Have you got anything against Betamax?
Oh, nothing at all, I promise. Trev strikes me as very much a Betamax sort of guy. In fact, higher quality, but more expensive all round. But VHS did win the format battle, you know. I do have a couple of people who are offering Betamax tapes for conversion, but I must admit that while I currently have 6 VHS players, I don't have a Betamax one. I'm waiting for the numbers of tapes requiring conversion to build up, and then I guess I'll go back on eBay and pick one up, but they'd be released wherever possible by VHS Rallies as usual. I'm not about to start a sister channel called Betamax Rallies anytime soon. Sorry, Trevor.
So there you go, folks. That's the end of this week's episode, and that's the end of this week's, or this season, rather. We're going to have a couple of weeks away, as we normally do. Sorry, I know we've just had a week away, but it's just the way things panned out. But we're going to have a couple of weeks away. We're working on some new bits and pieces as well, which hopefully we'll talk to you about when we come back. We've got some interesting guests as ever lined up, and we're going to try and do more of the same and maybe try and do it a little bit better. But thank you so much for sharing the love and telling people about it. And genuinely, Trevor and I were talking about this before we recorded the top of the podcast. When he was on Deja Vu, people were talking to him about the podcast. I think the best way of describing it is, when somebody says they really enjoy it, it gives us the impetus to kind of keep pushing and keep trying to make good podcasts, to be honest with you. It does make a difference. And of course, it does make a difference because without Kielder, we wouldn't be here. And of course, we're really appreciative of those guys. And we're trying to do some more bits and pieces with those guys as well, maybe for season 18. And but the guys who come up to us and tell us that they really enjoy the podcast, and it's not an ego thing, it's just, it can be really, really hard work for all of us, really. And that includes Alistair, of course, you've just heard doing the answers. You know, sometimes we have to turn these podcasts around really, really quickly to keep them relevant as well. So the pressure's on all of us. And genuinely, an hour-long podcast probably takes about 3 or 4 hours to do. And then all the publishing and stuff like that. So it can be anywhere between 4 and 5 hours to do an hour-long podcast. So when you get a two-hour one, you can do the math, as the Americans would say. But we do it for the love, and we do it for basically any love you guys show is really, really appreciated, and it does make a difference. And hopefully... we will be back in a few weeks' time with season 18, trying to do more of the same. As I say, trying to do something better. But if there's anything you guys would like us to try and do, by all means, we're always open to suggestion within reason. studio@absoluterally.co.uk, that's where we can find us. That's dead easy. Of course, obviously, Twitter and Facebook goes without saying these days. You know where we are on there as well. But emails, I don't know. Email still feels a bit like... I get a little bit excited when I get an email in the inbox. Social media is very, very easy to do, but I get that. But it's about like getting a letter yesteryear. There you go. I'm babbling on now anyway. Folks, this has been season 17. This has been episode 10. I genuinely hope you've enjoyed it. We've had a blast doing this season, and we can't wait to start next one. Thanks for the download, folks. Same time, same place, your little podcast hole in a couple of weeks' time.
Absolute Rally. Powered by the Kielder Works team. Spread the word and download the podcast every week.